Blog Talk Radio
presents Applause Radio Show.
Everybody, welcome to Applause Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and we're just coming off the heels of Jerry Jewell from last night. Actress, comedian Jerry Jewell, you probably know her best from playing Cousin Jerry on Facts of Life. We had a wonderful conversation. What a sweetheart. And tonight we've got a great show. I'm excited. Mr. Boone, he put it together for me, and he made it happen, and I'm so excited that he's joining me tonight. I'm a big fan of the Love and Spoonful, so tonight we've Steve Boone, and he's from the Love and Spoonful. So before we start, let me just say a quick thanks to our sponsors, the Hive Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, KWV Wines in South Africa, Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake, The Observer Newspaper in Kearney, New Jersey, GenieBottles.com, and oh my God, there's so many, but I'm dying to talk to Steve. Steve, how are you, sir?
No, I'm fine, Joanne. How are you doing?
I'm good. But thank you so much for making this happen. I know you're just coming off of a little gig over there. Where were you playing in Florida?
No, well, actually, yeah, no, I was not playing in Florida. I live in Florida, but I was up in Minnesota, actually, in a town just outside of Minneapolis called Red Wing, Minnesota. And the drummer for the Love and Spoonful, Mike Arturi, lives in Red Wing, Minnesota, and he also has a music school, the Universal Music Center in Red Wing, that's very successful, teaching a lot of people how to play music, which is a good thing. And Mike put this show together at a local theater, the Sheldon Theater in Red Wing, and what it was a band that it's not a on the road band, but for a couple of special shows, it's called A Spoonful of Love. And the players were just all first-class players, and I couldn't have been more happy to be with them. And then what I did, I spoke with Mike about the history of the band live from the stage, but then at the end, I debuted not a brand new song. It's a song I wrote quite some time ago, but I've never found a way to get it to my satisfaction. We tried a lot of different ways performing it, and then we came up with this acoustic version of it, which is what I did at the show in Minnesota. It went over real well, and one of the things I liked about it, it's a true story. It wasn't constructed out of some kind of a thing that you imagine, like most songs are. It was constructed from an actual true story that happened to me when I was looking for a sailboat to sail away from everything and just get myself back together again after 3 hard years of touring with the Love and Spoonful.
What's the name of it?
The name of the song is called Cygnus, the Northern Cross, and it's Cygnus, as you may know, is a constellation in the northern sky, and it includes the star Cygnus, and that was also the name of my sailboat. That's why it's called Cygnus. And why the circumstances leading up to that particular boat were so strange that it almost cried out to write a song about this. And if you have if you can stand, let me tell you a bit of a long story here.
It's absolutely.
Too long, but,
go ahead.
Go back to in the spring of 1968, the Love and Spoonful did its last concert in the 60s at a baseball stadium in Richmond, Virginia. Tiny Tim was our opening act, and It was a terrific show, but I was so looking forward to it because I had already announced to the band that after that concert, John was leaving, and I said, I'm going to be leaving too. There was going to be one more album to be put out, but I had a little bit to do with that. But I really wanted to get away from the touring schedule that we had. We were on the road for up to 250 days a year in 1967. And so my dad always subscribed to National Geographic magazine. And I was in February of 68, I was visiting his house, and I picked up a copy of the February issue. And on the cover was a story about the United States Virgin Islands. And there was a picture of a sailboat anchored off a beach on St. John's, one of the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I never forgot that picture because it was so evocative of what I was looking for, a boat to live on and sail on and just get away from all the high-pressure life of being on the road. And so I put that magazine down, and I had one more commitment. I was producing a band for Mercury Records called the Ox Pedals. And I said to myself, if once that project is finished, I'm going to get myself a sailboat. And this is something I had wanted to do my entire adult life. And so in the spring, after that last concert in Richmond, I started looking at boat listings. And we picked three. My wife and I picked three boats that were all supposed to be located in the Virgin Islands. And we flew down there. And the first two that we looked at were nice boats, but they really weren't up to my standards, and I just didn't think it was going to work out. And then the broker said, well, unfortunately, the third boat, Cygnus, has left the Virgin Islands and has sailed down islands to Grenada, I think it was headed. And so that was very disappointing. So we didn't get to see Cygnus, we thought. Then I said, let's go to St. John's for the day before we fly home and just go out, get on a beach and take some sun and see what happens. And as we approached Trunk Bay, which is a very popular beach in St. John's, I looked out the corner of the taxi's window, and there in the cove was that same picture that was on the cover of the National Geographic magazine in my dad's house a year before that. And it turned out that the boat had not left the Virgin Islands. It had stayed to show the boat to another prospective buyer. So when I got to the beach, I swam out immediately to the boat and I asked the skipper, I said, is the boat still for sale? He said, yes, it is. And if you can wait about a half an hour and come back, I'll be glad to show it to you. He was showing the boat to somebody else at the time.
Right.
So the wife and I swam out there half an hour later and just fell in love with the boat. And it was so coincidental that it happened to be there when we were told it wasn't there, and that it was in the exact same location of the picture that got me started on this whole trip to begin with in Trunk Bay. So the name of the sailboat was Cygnus, as I said, and I felt it was meant to happen. And I was so convinced it was meant to happen, I just made a deal on the spot with the owner of the sailboat, and we concluded the deal 2 months later. I had a yard sale where everything that wouldn't fit in two 4x4x4 shipping crates were sent down to St. Thomas, and we moved lock, stock, and barrel onto the sailboat with a dog and a cat and a little pump organ and a guitar. And I intended to write some new songs and just have a good time sailing around, which is what my intentions were to begin with. And that's what I did. And so that's where this song came from, my experience of finding the Cygnus and how it found me, actually.
Yeah, and do you still have it? Do you still have it and sail the world?
No, I don't. I sold the boat 3 or 4 years later and moved back to, actually just was visiting Baltimore, but that visit turned into my taking ownership of a recording studio that was in Baltimore. And we recorded some very well-known artists, including Little Feat and Seldom Seen. And so we had a very nice run with our recording studio in the Baltimore suburbs. And then I bought the facility at an auction and moved the entire operation onto a barge that was in the Inner Harbor of Baltimore. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Baltimore and its Inner Harbor, but it's nowadays it's one of the most expensive places in the whole East Coast to live. It's such a fabulous downtown. But when I moved to Baltimore in 1973, nobody went downtown anymore. It had become a desert. And all after the 5 o'clock hour on the business days, everybody just headed out to the suburbs, and essentially downtown Baltimore was deserted at night.
Right.
But we were there. We were able to see its growth into the harbor place that it is today, with its fabulous waterfront dining and shopping and just walking around the harbor. Baltimore is a tremendous city. I love it there. I'm not a fan of winter weather, and that's probably what drove me back to Florida in the first place. But nonetheless,
I've actually been there. I went there maybe around 6 or 7. When my kids were smaller, we went to Baltimore, and we were there at the waterfront, and it was really, really nice.
Oh, yeah, they did a great job with it. And I got it when living here. I didn't plan on moving to Baltimore. I was visiting a band that I had met actually in the Virgin Islands when I lived there, and then I liked the city so much and bought the recording studio. I decided to get a house there. And so we had just a terrific time. My years in Baltimore were very fond years. I remember them well, and I always enjoy going back and seeing my friends and having some crabs. And it's a great town. I have nothing sad or bad to say about Baltimore. It's one of my favorite places to go in the whole world.
Great, great. Now, I saw you were playing with my buddy Vern Schenk from the Cherry Drops.
That's right. Well, you know, Vern is a fixture here in Flower Beach. We both live in the same town.
Oh.
And I moved here in 2014 and met Vern almost immediately.
He's a sweetheart.
As you know, I'm sure. He's a sweetheart man, and he also operates a wonderful radio station.
Yep.
That is just got terrific DJs and a great playlist. And so Vern and I became friends, and I actually played bass on a couple of his recordings. And then we've done a couple of gigs where I sit in with his band, the Cherry Drops, and we have a great time. This was the second time we actually played in a large audience. We were at the Hard Rock Cafe a couple of years ago. They opened in Daytona Beach. And so this one was at the Flagler Performing Arts Center, which is connected with the Flagler Palm Coast High School, which is the primary high school here in Flagler County. But, yeah, we both live in the same town, so we see each other all the time. And Vern's a terrific guy, a great promoter of live music. And his band is just a hard-working band. They're a terrific band to work with, to be around, and just go out and listen. They're great.
Well, he did a great job on You Didn't Have to Be So Nice. It sounds great. His vocals were fantastic on it.
Yeah, and, you know, it was very interesting because it's slightly different than the way the Love and Spoonful did it. So
right.
In some ways, my muscle memory was going to play it the Love and Spoonful way, and I had to keep reminding myself it's not that you play it a little differently with the Cherry Drops.
Mm.
But that's okay. It worked out real good, and it sounded great, and I was real pleased to do it, and look forward to doing more things in the future with Vern. He's very, very active and a promoter of music, and I'm
yeah, he's a busy guy. He's a busy guy and a nice guy. Nice guy. We've spoken a couple of times, and definitely a sweetheart. I want to get them on, the Cherry Drops, him or the band, or I need to reach out to him. I think they're working on a new project, too, I think, with Ron Dante. I'm not 100% on that.
That's right. They are. I don't know how far along they are, but I know they've not only talked about it, but it has begun.
Mm-hmm. I wish you had a recording of the new song, the acoustic version. We could have played that tonight.
Well, here's what I could have sent it to you, and here's why I'm holding back on it. When I first wrote the song, like I said, it was a true story, and it journeyed almost like a poem. It didn't really read like a song. It didn't have a bridge in it. It didn't have a chorus. All four verses just told the whole story from the day I got to the beach to the day I left the islands and moved back to Baltimore. And so the song, I sing backup parts very well. Lead vocals are a bit of a challenge for me, so I have to be very careful to not convince myself something's better than I think. In other words, what I'm saying to you is that I wasn't satisfied with how I'm singing it yet because it was a live show. The audience loved it because I told a story behind it, and so it was all part of the performance. But really, to send it out as a recording where it goes out over the airwaves and people hear it, I'm not exactly thrilled with how my vocal. I'm still working on getting a better vocal for it. And when I do, I'll send you a copy.
Oh, I'd love to play it. Definitely, definitely. I got to ask you. I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. And I got to ask you, you've probably been asked this a million times, where did the name The Lovin' Spoonful come from?
You ever heard of a blues singer by the name of Mississippi John Hurt?
Yeah.
He's from the Mississippi River, the Delta Blues area down near New Orleans and Louisiana. And John Sebastian was a big fan of Mississippi John Hurt. In fact, when John would come to Greenwich Village to perform there in the early 60s, John would be his helper, his assistant. He would play harmonica on some of the blues tunes, and he would accompany him sometimes. But he loved Mississippi John Hurt. And when the name of the band was brought up, John said, you know, as you know, he's talking to the band now. He's saying, you know, I'm a big fan of Mississippi John Hurt, and there's a song on one of his albums called The Coffee Blues. And in that song, after he played it, I understood what he was saying. In that song, there is a lyric that goes, I love my baby by the Lovin' Spoonful. And John suggested, what do you guys think of this as a name for a band? And I was like, I don't think it's a good name for a band. I said, never heard a name like that for a rock and roll band. So I said, well, John, I'm just one voice out of four, but I don't think I would vote for it. To put a long story to a shorter conclusion, about a week later, I had heard the record enough times to know that this really is a name that's going to fit with the kind of music we wanted to create. So the name came from that Mississippi John's Coffee Blues and the line, I love my baby by the Lovin' Spoonful. And it referred to that last spoonful of sugar in his morning coffee.
Oh, cool. No, I had no idea. I had no idea. Now, I've got to ask go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, over the years, there's been a lot of misunderstanding about it. Many people thought it was relating to the spoonful of drugs that people use when they're cooking up heroin or methamphetamine or whatever.
I never even thought that.
Yeah, no. Well, that was not discouraged by our record company. And we were very mad about it. We were, like, very upset. You know, we don't want to be promoting drug use. And we all were pot smokers. So, I mean, it wasn't like we were being hypocrites. It just wasn't. Our music was called good time music for a reason.
Right.
We wanted people to think they were going to have some good times by listening to our music. And so, stoned or not, that was up to them. We weren't going to promote it. So
that's
pretty much how the name of this band got confused, but really mostly after people heard the real story and they didn't really care where the name came from. They just liked it.
Yeah, right. Well, it's definitely different. Definitely different. So coming up with it is definitely original. That's for sure.
Well, you know, one of the nicest compliments we got when we were starting out was John and I, Bob Dylan invited John, he called when we were at our very first rehearsal out on Long Island and I closed for the Winter Hotel. And I get the phone call and it was from Bob Dylan, who I was a huge fan of. And he knew John Sebastian from the Village. And he was having some recording sessions and he wanted John to come in. He didn't know that John had hooked up with a real bass player, but he said he wanted John to come in and play some bass parts. But John didn't have a car, so I said, John, I'll drive you. We're bringing my bass with me just in case.
Right.
And so we drove into New York and had these great sessions. I played on about four songs on Bringing It All Back Home album by Bob Dylan. And as a result of that, Bob and the band became friendly, let's say, or were pals. And when the Like a Rolling Stone came out, before it was even released on the radio, he invited us all up to his apartment and in Gramercy Park in New York City, and we heard a test pressing of it. And so the reason I mention all that is Bob said, you know, my expectations for the Love and Spoonful is that they are an experimental band. And I really like that description because I thought we were experimenting. We were using instruments that nobody used on rock records, like an auto harp and a zither and things that weren't played on rock records. We also were approaching it. Two of the band members were rock and roll background, and two of the band members were folk music background. So we were bringing those two styles of music together. And I liked it that Bob Dylan called us an experimental band because I thought we were.
Well, what I like about your band is like every song is different. They're not the same. That, you know, like you could hear when you're playing, you can tell it's you guys, but it's just, every song, it's not one genre. Like, I mean, you listen to Summer in the City, and then you listen to
right.
You Didn't Have to Be So Nice. Totally two
right.
different realms, you know? So that's what I loved about the band. It just didn't have this one style. You know, you had versatility.
And that was on purpose because at the time in 1964, it was record company practice, and they did it with every artist they had, that if they had a hit record, hit single, they wanted you to go back in the studio and have another one that sounded just like the first one.
And right.
He said, we're not going to do that. We're going to be an experimental band, and every cut we make is going to be different than the one before. And largely, we succeeded, I think.
I think so. I got to ask you about, you know, the band did this band, what, 68, I think? I'm not even sure about the exact date. Would you say that you disbanded because John left, or was there other issues?
No, there were other issues, and the other issues were 250 days on the road in 1967. We were wore out. We were just wore out. You know, we may have been the first big-time rock band to play the college circuits. Up until 1965, most colleges had folk music or jazz for their entertainment. They thought rock music wasn't appropriate for colleges. But with the Love and Spoonful style of music, we were one of the first bands to play on college campus, a rock band, jazz, not country and not folk. And so that opened the door for unlimited type of gigs, you know, not just Chicago and Milwaukee and New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Miami, but it was also, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, and it was like Cambridge, Massachusetts, and anywhere where there was colleges, Philadelphia, Harrisburg, Baltimore, you name it, we were playing in the college campuses. But after 67 and 250 days on the road, and hardly any time to have a home life. It was just go play, go sleep, baby, and go play again the next night. And so
right.
I think that when John said he wanted to go and pursue a solo career, I was totally supportive, as I've always been of John's things. You know, John is a terrific songwriter. John's a terrific all-around person, but he's also a very gifted songwriter. And so his songs were really what opened the door for us. And so I supported his decision. And I said, you know, maybe it's time for me to produce this band that I had been working with, the Oxpedals. And also, perhaps it's time to take some time off from the music business and get recharge your batteries, so to speak. And that's just what I did.
Now, how old were you guys when everything was taken off, when you were touring these 250 days?
I was, when the band first hit in 1964, I was 21 years old. And so you go down to 1968, and that's only 4 years later. So I was about 25 when the band stopped touring. And then when I was 26, I moved to the islands onto the sailboat. And so it was all in my early 20s.
And you lived your life on the boat. That must have been an amazing experience.
It was a learning experience. Not only was it amazing in terms of doing what I really had hoped I would be able to do, but it was a learning experience. You know, it's one thing to know how to sail. I was very successful at racing little sailboats when I was a youngster in St. Augustine, Florida.
Mm.
But living on a boat where you've got to generate your own electricity, you've got to keep your fresh water separated from the salt water.
It's a lot
of
work.
You have to make sure all the machine parts are working, that all the repairs are being made. So, and if you don't have a budget to pull into the nearest boatyard every couple of months, then you got to learn how to do it yourself. And I didn't have a budget to be able to pull in every couple of months for repair work. So I learned how to do it myself. And it was a great learning experience. In addition to the recharging my batteries, I also recharged my ability to be self-sufficient.
Right.
And so that was very important for me too. And I enjoyed every minute of it.
Nice, nice. What was the furthest you went on your boating excursions?
I sailed to South America a few times, Colombia. Mm. I sailed to Grenada. I sailed to Martinique and Dominica. Sailed to Antigua. Sailed to St. Martin. We sailed to Saba and Montserrat and Jamaica. And
wow.
Let's see. And then the Caymans they're almost in the Western Caribbean. In fact, they are in the Western Caribbean, the Cayman Islands. I've been there on a sailboat. And I've also been to the Central America, Belize and Guatemala Anyway, all the Central American countries, I sailed to them too.
Wow, all that in 3 years. Wow.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a lot of water to cover, but once you're living on your boat, you're not stopping for the night at a motel. You just keep going.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a watch system where somebody is always on the helm and staying awake and keeping on course. But it's much different than traveling by car, where you normally don't sleep in your car. You stop
right,
at a motel
right.
and get a room or something. So,
right.
so yeah, so that's why it was a doubly good experience for me, and it was also a very good learning experience.
Nice, nice. Now, I got to ask you, after the band broke up, you took your little sabbatical on your boat sailing around. Did you put out any more music after that, or you've just been writing and playing for yourself?
I did, actually, as a spinoff from the band that I produced. I did some recording on my own, and this is a story that I enjoy telling, but it never came to a good ending, so I'll tell you anyway, because I wrote this song called If I Stare,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was a great song. I was very happy with it. I encouraged my friend Stevie Souls, who's somebody I went to high school with and lived in East Hampton, Long Island, where I was living in high school days. And I encouraged him to sing the song for me because he had a great voice. And he and I wrote commercial jingles together, so we knew each other's style of playing. So we went up to my producer's office, and we did a live demo for him of the song. And I played guitar, and Stevie sang it. And when the song was over, Charlie Kaufman turned to his partner, Don Ruman, and said, "This song is an effing hit." Mm. And so he said, this song is as good a hit as anything you guys have ever done, meaning the Spoonful.
Mm.
So I said, well, great. Then give me a budget and let me go record it. And the recording didn't come out to anybody's satisfaction. It wasn't until 20 years later, and this was a band that I started with my then wife, Lena, who we got married in 1991. And then check that back. We got together in 1991. And we married some years later, but we started this band, and here was the theme for the band. It was called Fork, the name of the band, sort of a takeoff on Spoonful, but it was a virtual band, meaning that if we had a successful hit record, the band would go on tour and promote it. But until we had a successful hit record, we would only put the music out on the internet. This was in the very early days of the internet in the 1990s.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And so we recorded the song again. I thought it came out, did a great job, but it didn't catch on as a single. And so the two times trying to put it out as a hit didn't work, but it's a great recording. I can send you the recording of it that we did for the band called Fork that was much better than the one that I did for the demo for the producers. So in the end, it got done, but it took a while. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the name of the song again. I want to write it down so I can check it out.
Called If I Stare.
If I Stare. Yeah, I'm going to check it out after the show and listen to it. But I'm sure it's great. I'm sure it's great. So let me ask you this now. What do you think of this phenomenon of everybody that loves the old stuff? It just is never going away, thank God. I mean, it must be. I mean, here you're sitting back and get a call from Vern and the guys, and they say, come on, let's go do this gig. And you're like, yeah, I'm there, you know. And, like, this music will never die. And
well, you
did
know,
did you ever anticipate that?
Well, yes, I did anticipate it. And for the simple reason was that what we chose to call it, Good Time Music, that motto, if you will, is enough to keep people interested. You know, it's not hard rock music. It's not death metal music. It's not all the names that are supposed to imply very loud, very, you know, pounding drums and amplifiers turned up to 11. The band was never that kind of a band. So I did expect that 50 years later, I would hear Do You Believe in Magic on the radio still, you know, or Summer in the City. It's been used by commercials. You know, yeah. BMW used it a year ago for a wonderful commercial. Do You Believe in Magic was just used for a commercial by a big grocery store chain. And so the answer to your question is, did I ever expect that this would be the case? Well, I didn't understand in 1960 how long the record business was. When I was a kid in the 1950s, by the time you turned 30, if you didn't have a real job, you were going to end up very poor because hardly anybody got rich in the music business except for the movie people. And so we didn't expect it to be money making, but I always thought that the good music, the music that gives people a good time feeling, will always be popular. So yes,
it'll never go away.
To your question.
It'll never go away. And it's funny, like depending on what you're doing, these songs just come to your head. I can't even tell you how many hot days I'll be walking down the street and I'll be like, you know, especially in New York. You know, if you're working in New York and all of a sudden, hot town, summer in a city, you know, it's like, and it's true. And it's, I must have shared that song a million times on Facebook every summer when it's hot. Believe in Magic, that's another one that, you know, if something happens, it's like, yeah, do you believe in that? You know, and it's just, the songs are just timeless. They're timeless. And, you know, they say, oh, we write for the times. It doesn't matter. If the song is good, it'll live forever.
Well, I think so, too. And I think when you take music to extremes, you know, there for a while, John Cage would experiment with making music without any instruments. He would just, like, put a spoon and tinkle a glass with it, or, you know, just sandpaper and rub a stick with it, but no musical instruments. But that never got very popular, obviously. And so experimental music for me meant trying different things, but not trying to turn off the audience, trying to turn on the audience. And that's what our goal was always, was to get the audience turned on by the music.
Right. And it worked. And it worked. Now, are you working on anything new now, Steve? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have a goal. I'm 77 years old, and my goal is to release an album of my original songs. Now, John and I are always kicking ideas around for new songs, so I hold out hope. In fact, there's one song that he really liked the idea of that I passed along to him. It's not a completed song. It was just the beginnings of a song, but he liked it enough that he's working on it to turn it into a song. So, yes, I'm always constantly working with writing new songs. Now, recording them is going to be a little more difficult because of my singing thing. I've got to be comfortable with how my voice sounds. And if I'm not, it's not going to turn out good. But I'm learning how to, even at this point in my career, I'm learning how to not try to do things that I'm not capable of doing and sticking within my comfort zone. So my goal is to have one more album that is not going to be a Love and Spoonful album. It's going to be a Steve Boone album. And quite possibly it'll be out in the not too far distant future.
Well, when it comes out, let us know. Come on back, we'll play it. And I'm sure the what's it sing? What's the name of the boat again? I'm so sorry.
Cygnus.
Cygnus. I'm sure that'll be on there.
Called a cygnet. Cygnus is a swan that flies across the sky, and so that's where the song came from. And the name of my boat was Cygnus.
Right, and I'm sure that'll be on the new album.
Oh, absolutely.
Great. Now, when you were with Spoonful, what was your participation in the writing? I know John Sebastian did a lot of the writing, so what was your part in writing the music, the songs, I should say, not the music?
Well, you know, the first song I ever wrote was at a beach party. And I thought songwriting was not in my wheelhouse. It just seemed too difficult. But I wrote this song at a beach party, and it was kind of inspired by that folk song called Michael Row Your Boat Ashore. And it was just a silly song, but I got a whole song done. So I said, you know, you can do this. If you have good people surrounding you, you can not only write a song, but you can get it made into a record. Once I had met John and Zolly, I knew we had the parts we needed to make the record sound good. So the first song that I wrote for the Love and Spoonful, John and I wrote it together. It was called "You Didn't Have to Be So Nice," and
that's
a
great song. It started,
and it started out with a slightly true story where I was Zolly wanted me to introduce this longtime friend of his from Toronto, a wonderful gal, and we did meet, but we never had a connection, romantically speaking. I still see her to this day. She's a great gal. Nurit Wild is her name. But we didn't hit it off romantically. So I wrote this title and a first verse, "You Didn't Have to Be So Nice, I Would Have Liked You Anyway."
Mm-hmm.
And then John helped me fill out the first verse, and he said, "Look, let's work together and make this our second single." And it came out, I think, the most important record a band can release is a single.
Mm.
Because if you don't get a hit on your second one, you're called a one-hit wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to avoid that, and we got "You Didn't Have to Be So Nice," made it into the top 10. And, you know, it's been done by a lot of people over the years, some real wonderful versions. I get probably more compliments about that song than any other song in the Spoonful catalog. I don't know why that is, but people are all the time writing and saying what a great song it is, or commenting on the, you know, in emails or support at the website and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites that you guys, I mean, I like all of them, don't get me wrong, but that's one of my favorites too. That's one of my favorites.
I think it's a great song. Yeah. Love it. Still to this day, every time I hear it, it's great.
Mm. When you hear it, this is a stupid question. You know, when we hear it, your average Joe, when they hear the song, it obviously takes them back to when they first heard it and the memories that the song takes them back to. Now, when you hear it, obviously it must take you back to the studio and performing it live, writing it. I mean, you've got all those memories behind it, where we have a memory of what we were doing at the time, you know, which is totally different than what you guys were doing at the time.
Well, it's not totally different, Joanne, because like I told you, in February of last year, of 2020, February, right before the COVID-19 hit, John and I and Joe Butler flew out to California and took part in a concert that was put on by this organization called the Wild Honey Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Wild Honey Orchestra does is every year they select a band from the 1960s that they were fans of, and then they do a tribute show, one night only, to that band, and members of the band are invited to come out and take whatever part they want. And the organizer said, you know, most people don't come, but we offer the invitation. So the invitation went out to John and John and me and Joe, and we all said yes, and we showed up for it. And Nurit Wild, the gal that You Didn't Have to Be So Nice was written about, was there at the show a year ago. So I hadn't seen her in a few years. So, yeah, it was nice to see Nurit again and catch up with her, how her comings and goings have been over the years. She ended up actually becoming friends with Michael of the Monkees.
Michael Nesbitt.
What's his name? I haven't seen him. Yeah.
Yeah, Michael.
So anyway, it was good to see her, and the show was terrific. It was just done so well, and it's a charity event, so it's for autism awareness. And I said to John when it was over, I said, John, you know, if this is the last thing that the Lovin' Spoonful does as a live performance, I'll be happy with it. Because the band that was put together were terrific musicians, and the show it was a sold out show. It came off wonderfully. The video that was made from it is a good video. And so I have nothing to be sorry about with that. And they took great care of us. They were very careful to make sure they were playing the songs the way we wanted to have them heard. And I played bass on about 5 songs, and Joe sang on some of the songs, and John sang on some of the songs and played guitar. So the only thing missing was Zoe. You know, unfortunately, Zoe passed away in 2002, so that was not going to be possible.
Right. Now, when you guys do the, the Flower Power Cruises, do you guys all do them, or is it just a few of you, or does the whole band get together?
No, we've done, in the last 10 years, I'd say we've done probably 6 cruises, maybe a few more, but I know we did the Flower Power now twice. We've done Concerts at Sea twice. We've done another Rock in the Caribbean with Rocky and the Rollers. And, you know,
and that's the whole band, or just a few of you get together?
No, it's the whole, well, it's the new Lovin' Spoonful, which is
the
Joe
new
Bauer,
version.
Steve Boone. And then Mike Arturi, the drummer from Minnesota, a guitar player from Arkansas, Phil Smith, and then a second player, keyboards and vocals, Murray Weinstock from New York. And so that band is the Lovin' Spoonful today. John has been invited to be part of it. He doesn't want to go out again as Spoonful, and that's certainly his right. It is... All the cruises have been that band, not with the original members. Of course, Zoe passed away. So,
yeah.
And John doesn't want to do them. So
I'd love to see one of those. I'm got to get on one of those someday if they ever come back, the cruises, because the acts are just. I just don't know. Now, you mentioned the Monkees earlier. Now, I don't know if I heard this or if this was rumor or what, but were you guys supposed to actually be the Monkees, or you were supposed to be part of that?
They approached us. Yeah, the producers for the show, after we'd had Do You Believe in Magic was a hit, and You Didn't Have to Be So Nice was just hitting the airways, and we got a call from our manager to meet them at an office in New York City, and we met these producers, and they pitched us on the idea of the Lovin' Spoonful becoming this band that would be on a television show, and it would feature how we write our songs and record them, and they're sort of like the Beatles movie, Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
That was the inspiration for it. So it was going to be gag stuff put in. And then they said, and the only thing we're going to ask of you boys to do is you got to change your name to the Monkees. And we all looked at each other and said, well, let's get back to you later. And we got outside and we huddled down with the manager, producer, and the 4 members of the band and said, look, we've already got a hit record. We've already got a hit record by a band called the Lovin' Spoonful. If we change our name to the Monkees, and we have to start all over again. What if that record isn't a hit? Then we've just given up the Lovin' Spoonful and all the goodwill. So we decided to say, thank you, but no thank you. And I'm glad we did. I think we would have been successful. I obviously would have made a pile of money, but money's not the only thing I'm interested in. And so the band, as to a man, said no thank you, but thank you for offering it to us and good luck with it. And as it turned out, it was a big, I have Peter from Greenwich Village way before the Monkees was even being considered. He was a friend of mine then. He was, one of the buskers that would go from coffee house to coffee house playing, passing the hat and playing guitar and singing. So, and of course, Davey and Mike, not Michael Nesbitt, but I'm having real senior man. He was at the Wild Honey show too. The other fellow. In the Monkees, but anyway, it doesn't matter. But they, they did great. They had a wonderful run as the Monkees, and I'm glad for them. And the Spoonful had a wonderful run as Lovin' Spoonful, and never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, that's pretty weird that they would ask you to. I mean, what a great opportunity to do it, but to change your name to the Monkees. I mean, that's ridiculous. You're already riding high. Why would you want to, change your name in the middle of your success?
I have to guess at that. I would have to guess and say they did market research based on the Beatles. And of course, the Beatles were sort of like the bug, the Beatle bug. And so they,
right.
I think these guys thought we got to connect it with some kind of an animal or something that's identifiable with. And so Lovin' Spoonful didn't identify with anybody. And so they just said, let's see, you got to change your name. But I'm glad we didn't. Look, it would have been a wonderful thing, I'm sure. But I didn't want to be making television shows. I wanted to be making records and touring and supporting the records.
Making music, right. Exactly. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, I have to say thanks for, I know you're just getting off of the gig and just coming home, and to come on and talk to me after all that. I'm sure you're tired, and to spend the evening with me. I really do appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much. I really do.
Well, it's my pleasure, Joanne. So interesting questions, and I enjoyed the talk, and I'll send you some stuff too. As soon as I get some finished cuts that I can send out to you, I'll let you know what we're doing.
Yes,
you can give it a listen and make comments.
I'd love to have it on. You kidding? And also, what about the book you wrote? What? Tell us about the book.
Oh, the book is terrific. The book, I've had a long time to think about writing a book, because for 30 years or so, nothing was happening with the Lovin' Spoonful, and I had all these stories to tell. So I started taking notes. Every time I would think about a story, I'd make notes on it. And then in 2013, I got an email from somebody wanting to do an article about my recording studio in Baltimore's Inner Harbor. And it was a man who had grown up in Baltimore, and he's younger. He's like, I think today he's in his 50s. But he had heard about this studio on a barge in the Inner Harbor, and he wanted to do an article about it. And his name was Tony Moss. And when we were talking, I said, well, Tony, I love what you're saying. And his job was, he was a sports reporter for ESPN, and he was going on to become a sports editor. So he had already had a good job. And so I liked him right away. And I said, well, Tony, I'll be glad to do the article. And the article came out wonderful. It was in Baltimore Magazine, and he didn't get anything wrong. He got all the quotes I gave him exactly right. He wrote a great article about it. And after the article came out, I called him up and said, Tony, is there any chance I could convince you to be a co-writer with me on a book about the Spoonful's history?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I would say yes right away, but the big problem is you live in Florida, and I live in Maryland, and at the time he was getting ready to be transferred to Connecticut, ESPN's headquarters. He said, I don't see how we can get together enough to be able to get the basis for the book. And I said, well, let's please stay in touch, because I think you're such a tremendous writer, and you were able to capture my voice exactly on the article on the recording studio. And so we hung up saying goodbye and stay in touch. And then about a week later, I get a phone call. And I pick it up and say, Steve, hey, it's Tony Moss. And I said, hey, Tony, how you doing? What's up? He says, well, you're not going to believe this. I have just been transferred to Fort Lauderdale, and that's where I was living at the time. So he said, if I'm going to be in Fort Lauderdale and I'm going to be working there, I think we could do this book project, which made me go through the roof, because not only is he somebody I really got along with in terms of personality wise, but he was such a music fan and he knew things. He knew more about some musical things than I did. And so it was a marriage made in heaven in terms of, you know, just the saying, but it was just a wonderful collaboration. His style of writing, I would go down and just talk into a tape recorder for 18 hours at a time, and we just put all these facts together, and all those notes that I'd been keeping them, I loaded them up with those, and then we had to search for a publisher, and then 2014, that was almost 50 years since the band had been in its first hit record.
Yeah.
And the publishers all say, well, it's a great story. Nobody's written a Love and Spoonful book, but I don't think we can sell it because so much time has passed since you were a band with hit records. So we got passed on it by almost everybody. And then right when we were just about ready to give up, I got a phone call, and it was a publisher up in Canada, Jack David, ECW Press. And they had done books by a lot of people who I was fans of, the band Rush. Neil Peart, the drummer for Rush, had written some great books for ECW. So I knew they had a good reputation. And he said, well, listen, I'm going to be vacationing in Tampa in about a month. Why don't we have lunch someday and we'll discuss the possibility of this book deal? And so as the month drew closer, I called him up. I said, Jack, you're not going to believe this, but I just talked to John Sebastian, and he's doing a benefit in a suburb of Orlando in about 2 weeks. Why don't we combine our lunch date that we were going to have together with you coming over and hearing this concert that John and I are going to do, just the two of us? And we've done this in the past, so this wasn't a new thing. John and I have done duos over the years many times. And so John sent me a set list of what he'd like to do for this concert. And I practiced up. The keys were different than the Spoonful keys, but that's all right. I learned all the stuff I needed to learn. And we did the show, and Jack David, the publisher, came to the show. And after the show was over, he said, not only have you got a book deal, but I got to tell you something. What I just heard, an hour of music is as good as any concert I've ever heard in my life. And this guy's a super music fan. He's not just somebody who publishes books. He's a real music fan. And he just said it was so genuine, so authentic. And you can tell that he said, I could tell you guys didn't do this every day. There was little mistakes and things like that. But he said the energy and the authenticity of it was so great. He said that I can't not give you a book deal. So that's how the book came about. And then, you know, once it got released, it did well. It's hard to sell a book if you don't have a record or something out there to recommend people to. But I did some what they call book tours and talking engagements. And I'm actually planning to do a whole new run. I just ordered a new batch of books for myself. I sell them on my website. And also you can get them at Amazon. If you want, text me your address and I'll send you a copy of it.
Cool. And we're talking, what we're talking about is called Hotter Than a Matchhead, Life on the Run with the Love and Spoonful. And did anybody from the band contribute to the book, or it's just you and Tony?
What do you mean contribute? I mean, they contribute to the music.
Contribute to the stories, or is it all coming from you?
No, it's all coming from me. You know, you can't really write a book where a real book where every, you know, four different people are going to have four different opinions about things.
Yeah.
It would be chaotic. And so I wouldn't have wanted to do that because I told everybody I was writing it. I said, you know, get ready. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to fire away where I feel necessary. And everybody was fine with it. You know, John in the end was a little bit upset about some of the things in the book, but we're still the best of friends. You know, you get over those things, and so it worked out good. Everybody that's read the book has raved about it. They said it's a great book. It's a fascinating look inside the life of a rock band in the mid-1960s. And so I'm so glad that ECW, you know, published it. You know, Tony told me, because he's a professional writer, he says, because we were talking about maybe self-publishing if they can't get a publishing deal. And he said, well, I'm out of here. I can't do self-publishing. I'm a published author, and I need to stay that way. So
right.
I knew that if we didn't get a publishing deal, that Tony wasn't going to be part of the project. So I was so glad when Jack David came through for me. And still to this day, I thank the world of Jack David and the publishing company, ECW Press in Toronto.
Nice. How long did it take to write the book, to put it all together? I mean, because you're talking stories over 50 years old now. So how long did it take you to put everything together?
Oh, I'd say about a year after he moved down to Florida.
It was quick.
His wife would take the two girls and two kids and go visit their parents. So we had the apartment to ourselves for a whole weekend. And like I said, we just put a tape recorder on the table. He'd ask me a question and I'd start talking.
There you go.
And we did it for 18 hours a day for like 5 weekends.
Wow.
And that gave him all the material he needed. So within about a year, the rough form of the book, and then we had to go through the editing process with the publisher, which was another year almost.
Wow.
But by 2014, all that was done, and it was in fine form. And like I said, you know, it's out there now. You can still buy it. Everybody loves it that's ever read it. So I'm very glad you mentioned it. It's, you know, and as you probably know, Hotter Than a Match Head is a line from Summer in the City.
Yes.
So
yes.
That song, you know, I have writing credits on Summer in the City, and I've been very fortunate to have those writing credits because of how well that song has done over the years.
Yeah. Well, especially in the summer. It comes around a lot in the summer.
Oh, yes, it does.
Like I said, I mean, I walked down the street in New York on a sweltering day, and that song comes to my head. You know, it's the first song that comes to my head. So, and
well, it definitely has what they call shelf life.
Oh, definitely,
you know,
definitely.
The other term I love for it, it's called an evergreen song, meaning that it always generates income.
Yeah, forever. And evergreen is forever, right? Absolutely.
Yeah,
now,
well,
what is your...
Well, I like that.
Steve, yeah, well, that's what it means. Evergreen means forever. So what is your website, Steve?
SteveBoone.net.
SteveBoone.net.
Just my name, all lower... It could be any upper or lower, but better just all lowercase, SteveBoone.net. And then on the home page, the opening page, there's a little yet buy now button. I have to redesign the home page because people have said I couldn't find the buy button, but it's right there on the home page. It's a little yellow button, and you push it and you go right to the sales page.
Right.
And
it's a
good website too. There's a ton of information on that website about the band.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's got history of band members. It's got pictures. It's got stories about the band first starting, you know, the modern folk quartet. Jerry Yester joined the band in 1967, and he had been in the modern folk quartet, and they did a song called Whatever Happened to the Lovin' Spoonful. And I always liked that song, so that song, you can find that on my website too.
Cool. Now, I wanted to ask you, now, I know it's hotter than a match head is from a line from Summer in the City, but does the title, is there some stuff in there that is a little risque, or, you know, when you say hotter than a match head? There's some stories in there that we've never heard before about the band?
No, I'll tell you, the whole story is it was a working title. It was never meant to be the final title. Tony came up with it just to have a working title when we were pitching it out.
Mm-hmm.
And after he presented, I said, but Tony, I love it. I want this to be the, you know, not only is it speaking from my point of view, because the love is, when you read the book, you're going to see why it's been hotter than a match head. But it's also a line from Summer in the City, which is a song that I have writing credits on. So it's the ideal song to get a lyric from for a book title. And I'm very glad that Tony came up with it, because we were thinking of other titles that weren't nearly as good as Hotter Than a Match Head. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the subtitle is Life on the Run with the Lovin' Spoonful. And I've just written a new song. I haven't got the words finished, but I've started it called Life on the Run.
Wow. So well, I can't wait to hear you. I can't wait to hear the new stuff. I hope you do reach out to me when you have the new stuff and you can come back on and we'll let everybody hear it. And we'll play a couple songs and let everybody know it's out there. So I would love if you're up for that.
I appreciate the offer, and you'll be the first one that gets to hear them when they do get finished.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet of you. Well, Steve, I thank you so much. Is there anything you want the folks to know? Can they see you performing? I know you just finished the gig, but can anybody see you coming up anytime soon?
Well, you know, the concert scene is just now pulling on its bootstraps and trying to find a way to get people in seats again. Yeah. I have a feeling that by the time summer is almost over, starting in the fall, we've got two dates that were actually cancellations from last year that got moved to 2021, and they are in October and November. And I'm not going to say they may not be confirmed, and so I'm going to just say that we do have two dates on the calendar starting in October, and the Love and Spoonful website, loveandspoonful.com, it needs updating. I've got to update that. Ever since we stopped working, I stopped updating the website, but I'm going to update the calendar, and I'll put those dates that are on the schedule but not yet announced on the website's calendar.
Sounds great. Sounds great. I can't wait to check it out, and I can't wait to hear the new stuff, and you're going to be doing it very soon, so I can't wait.
It should be fun. You know, I would tell you the title of the album, but I'm not going to do it because it would give away too much too soon. But it's a great title. I love the title even more than the songs that are on it so far. But we'll see. You'll know when it's time to announce it. I'll let you know first.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, everybody, we've got Mr. Steve Boone from the Love and Spoonful here, and I enjoyed speaking with you tonight, Steve. And again, I appreciate you taking the time out. I know you must be exhausted after traveling and playing the gig. So I do thank you very much for spending the time with me tonight.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. I enjoyed it a bunch, Joanne, and we'll talk again soon in the future. I'll update you with the new music as soon as I can get something out to you. And I'll text me a copy of your mailing address, and I'll send you a copy of the book.
You got it. Steve, thank you so much. Everybody, Steve Boone, Love and Spoonful. Thank you so much. Thank you, sir. Well, Steve, thank you.
Take care. Very, very welcome.
Thank you. You take care. We'll talk very soon.
All righty. Have a good one.
All righty. Bye-bye. Thank you. All right. Steve Boone from Love and Spoonful. That was cool. I didn't know... I have to check out the book, Hotter Than a Match Head. You remember? Hotter Than a Match Head. Da, 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 da. Yep. Now, the reason I asked, I know it's maligned, but is there some stories in there that we don't know about? And, make calling it Hotter Than a Match Head. And hopefully I'll get to find out soon. So I really wish we could have played his new song, The Cygnus. But he's not ready yet. You know, the struggles of an artist is never knowing when it's perfect. And because you want it to be so good, and you never know when to stop. If you don't have somebody to tell you, it's good, leave it. You will work on it for the rest of your life. So anyway, but thank you so much, Steve. What a pleasure to speak with you tonight. I do appreciate it. And especially, like I said, you just got back from a gig in Minnesota, so, and then had to go down to Florida. So, but tomorrow. Oh, I forgot to ask Steve. I know he probably knows Dave. Dave Zane is on tomorrow night. We're going to be playing his new song, and Dave has played with every group out there, and he probably knows Dave from the circuit, I'm sure, because they do these, all these groups, our favorite groups, they do these Flower Power cruises or these get-together cruises, they're called, and it's all the, our favorite bands from the 60s and 70s, and what a show it's got to be. And I know Dave has played with several of the bands, and Dave also has his own band, too. I think it's called Bigger Picture. The Bigger Picture is the name of the band. And he's got a new song out, so he's going to be with us tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Hope you guys can make it. Colin Smith will be with us on St. Patty's Day. Hopefully we'll be playing some new music for him. I haven't received anything yet. And I can't wait to speak to actress, author, comedian Melanie Chardoff on Friday. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then Kevin Spiridus, he's going to be with us on the 21st. He's an actor. You probably know him from the soaps, and he's got a new, what's it called, Forever Together, I think it's called. He's got a new thing going on. And Alyssa Panitz, she's a divorce advice and divorce columnist reporter. So if you guys have any questions about divorce, feel free to call. She is more than happy to take the call. And then on the 27th, we've got coming up all the way from Ireland, we're going to do an afternoon show. Mr. Neil Byrne, he's formerly from the Celtic Thunder. And I think it's Byrne and Kelly is the new band he's in. And we're going to play a new song from him. And Alex Liu, director Alex Liu, he's got a new documentary out called Sexplanation. It's Sexplanation. If it's an, I don't know, but it's definitely Sexplanation. And then on the 31st, I'm excited as well for George Chakiris from West Side Story. So he's got a new book out too, and it's called My West Side Story, his journey, I guess, from when he starred in West Side Story and his career going forward. And April looks great. Oh, I'm so excited. We've got Juliet Mills coming up. We've got Deborah Wilson from Mad TV. We've got a lot going on. Like I said, we came in like a lion, and we're going to stay there. March, we came in like a lion, and we're going to stay there for you. Because I'd love to bring you great guests, and I love to talk to great guests, and just having a great time. And last night, I had a really lovely evening with Jerry Jewell. And if you didn't hear that, you may want to check that out. And you know, you could always go back and listen. Pardon me. I know you guys do. But you could always go back and listen to the shows at applauseradioshow.com, iHeart, Blog Talk, Hamilton Radio. There's so many we're on the platform. We're hoping in the next 2 weeks to be on Apple and Spotify and iTunes. So this way we'll be everywhere, everywhere. Everywhere, so which is really, really cool. So I'm excited about that. I'm a little tired, if you can hear it. I mean, who's not, right? And we changed our clocks an hour ahead today. We sprung ahead today, so it was nice having daylight longer. I just wish the weather was warmer. The last few days were nice, but today. It looked nice. It looked nice. If you looked out the window, you thought it was gorgeous. But when you got out there, it just the wind was. We're having a lot of heavy wind over here on the East Coast. So, anyway, yeah. Thank you so much again for listening. And thank you to Steve Boone. Check out his book. It's called Hotter Than a Matchhead, and it's the life on the road on. Yeah, Life on the Run with the Lovin' Spoonful. And he's going to have a new album coming out, so that's pretty cool. And he's going to let us play it for him, and I love that. And I appreciate that so much. So everybody have a good evening, and have a great week. We'll see you tomorrow with Dave Zane at 8 p.m. And in the meantime, be kind, folks. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.